Aren't you a technology supplier looking for deal flow? Then you should try our new platform, Connect. It's designed to help buyers and brands find the best tech solutions to match their campaign requirements. It's free for buyers to use and for tech suppliers to set up an account and start applying to campaign briefs. Set up your account today by visiting exchangewire.com/connect or email us at info@thewirecorp.com.
The MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this week's edition of the MadTech Podcast. Delighted to be welcoming our very special guest, not least of all because she sometimes is unavailable, and we're excited that we've managed to strong arm her into making herself available for this podcast. Isabel Bass, Managing Partner, Digital Data and Tech Strategy for Starcom. Hello.
Hello. It's good to finally be here.
Yeah. It is very good to finally have you here. And Lindsay Rowntree in the opposite corner to where I am of the ExchangeWire offices. Hello.
Hello.
The first story I wanted to chat through with the two of you was a good article written by Seb Joseph from DigiDay discussing the notion of brands in housing and to what extent the what we used to refer to as a trend is still a trend or a reality. The assertion in the article is that actually it's a way of working that's quite possibly in retreat to some extent. So I suppose just for the sake of this conversation, definition of brands in housing, which of course could be very varied and broad, is essentially excellent. Barking dog in the background.
Dog,
brilliant. Love
amazing.
It. It's not a
apologies.
Podcast without a dog barking. Without a dog barking or some form of building works or, you know, service person turning up to sort the washing machine out, that kind of thing. So for the purposes of this chat, in housing, effectively bringing some or all of your media buying capabilities in-house from a brand's point of view. Certainly something that we've been talking about for many years at ExchangeWire and, as I mentioned earlier, something that we referred to some years ago as a trend. The argument in Seb's article is that as a result of the pandemic, the degree to which brands were excited and enthusiastic or able and capable to bring various functions in-house has been variable. Perhaps that rate of in-house adoption has slowed because investment was slowing, or there might have been pause on various elements of investment and spend. And also, it's quite likely that some brands required a greater degree of flexibility during a time when things were very unknown, and possibly that may have meant that they'd rather rely on agencies and other service partners to help them out in terms of capacity and flexibility. I'm really interested to know what you both think about this. Certainly some of the conversations we've been having with brands more recently has definitely pointed to there being a preferred hybrid setup. So bringing some of those, having some of those capabilities in-house, but very much still partnering with agency experts on specific things. I'm sure, Isabel, you're going to have a point of view on that from your own personal experience. But the other thing that I've noticed in recent conversations with brands as well is that there's been a lot of discussion about in-housing not being simple and straightforward from a brand point of view. There's so many complications with setting up a new functionality within some large organisations. You've really got to have all of your ducks lined up in a row and a lot of buy-in from within the senior echelons of the organisation. And I wonder if that too has had partly an impact on what Seb from DigiDay has noted as a sort of retreating trend. So over to you, Isabel. What's your perspective on where brands are at with in-housing?
So I think all of what you've just said is spot on. We don't tend to have these conversations anymore as much. And I do think that the trend, whether it's slowed down or not, is a difficult one, because I know you have a global audience. But the way we sort of see it is that it's in-housing is always a means to an end. And I think where it used to be, it was a cost argument. And it's really hard to, it's easy to do this in the US, one market, scaled investment, one, possibly two languages, whereas in Europe, it's an absolute nightmare to make this economically work, right? So, you know, we've got so many different languages, so many different cultures. You've really got to understand the local context. the scale isn't necessarily exactly the same, you know, across all of those markets, yes, but on a market by market perspective. So I think it's definitely not a cost argument anymore. I think there was also a few years ago, it was about transparency and control. If you remember, cast your eyes back or your mind back to, you know, brand safety and a lot of that. And, you know, is programmatic, you know, how much value is in that value chain that shouldn't be sitting in the chain. But a lot of that is sort of the industry's worked with, right? So yes, brands have invested in their own tech. They're doing their, some of them are doing their own deals. They want to really understand digital a lot more. And I think that was one of the drivers. But I think agencies have started to work maybe in a slightly different way with them in order to address what the means to the end actually was. So what are you hoping to get out of it? Is it cost? Well, actually, cost argument isn't necessarily the right one for Europe. And that's why we're seeing it a lot less in Europe versus the US. Is it about, you know, being able to create that hybrid model, as you said, where we can top up with additional talent? Is it about, you know, delivering services more cost efficiently by maybe hubbing it somewhere? And then we have still local market expertise, but we organize ourselves slightly differently within the agency. Is it about control and having access and insight into a lot of the technology investments that they've made? And to be frank, right now, everyone's just talking about transformation. All of the pitch asks are, help me transform. And that is very much in partnership. And it's so nice to not, I mean, we still have price conversations, obviously. But the conversation I find is much more around future facing. Help me innovate. Help me make more out of maybe what I have invested in. Help me scale up my internal talent where maybe I have internal talent. But, you know, I just cannot handle the volume or the spikes in delivery. So how can the agency work with me as a partner? And I think that's the interesting conversation. And that's definitely, so we've come out of this us versus them almost and more into a partnership of actually how we can support. And that is really the heart of the agency, isn't it? It's there as a service provider and as a partner to help and answer the need and provide solutions rather than being seen as a supplier. I don't think any one of us want to be a supplier.
Lindsay, what's your perspective on it? And certainly, like, Isabel brings up so many things that we've talked about in the office here at Exchange Wire and that we've wondered about, to what extent are those things feeling real, you know, for brands and for agencies who are having these conversations about how best to organise the support that brands want from the service layer, how best for agencies to provide that.
I think it's fascinating to hear from Isabel's perspective that actually it's a bit of a non-story, if you kind of put it that way, that actually...
Correctly.
When you talk about in-housing, it used to be, and Isabel mentioned it, you know, talking about sort of 2015, 16, 17, where there was this kind of us versus them, and it felt like a bit of a fight and attack between agencies and brands, and it was all kind of very awkward, and it was around transparency and brand safety. And as Isabel said, a lot of work's been done since then on both sides of the coin to improve that. So, and even then it came to the definition of in-housing, and, you know, when you talk about in-housing, everyone was assuming it meant that everyone was basically telling agencies to bugger off, and it was only about doing everything themselves, not using managed services, just kind of basically running everything internally, building their own agencies, building their own tech platforms, whatever else. And that was never really the case either. And you do now have some big brands that have fully in-housed or in-housed to as much as they can or they want to, and some that will always have a hybrid approach, and many that will still always rely on the agency model. And I think that, you know, we talked a lot, as you said, Rachel, in the office about what the future of the industry looks like. And we are entering an age of reckoning when it comes to the future of the third-party cookie, the future of measurement and targeting, and what that looks like. You've got Google's Flock, you've got contextual, you've got the anonymous web. And actually, brands are going to struggle to navigate all of that themselves. And agencies are really, really well placed to be able to help them navigate that based on the leverage agencies have in the industry and the relationships they have with tech partners. And they're in a really good place to be able to go out and find out exactly who can do what and how they can make that work for their different client bases and use that expertise knowledge to be able to go and work with those different brands and say, based on this, we recommend X, Y, Z. I think that is, you know, in the kind of the re-architecture of what the industry will look like, agencies are extremely well placed to deal with that. And that, I think, from where we sit, is very, very exciting. But I think that, yeah, I do wonder if, particularly, I mean, again, the brands that were mentioned in the article were kind of very US brands. And as Isabel said, you know, in the US, it's an easier conversation to have because it's one market. Yes, those 50 states all act very, very differently, but ultimately you are talking about one market and largely one language, apart from obviously the kind of, you've basically got English and Spanish for the most part, but across Europe and across APAC, it becomes such a difficult conversation. Unless you are a one market company, how are you going to navigate that and manage that? So I think that it seems like a non-story. And I'm delighted to hear that actually the conversation shifted to digital transformation. And the next question there will be, okay, how are we defining that? And Isabel, like, fascinated, kind of, when these brands are asking you for digital transformation, what the hell does that look like? And what's an agency's role in helping deliver that?
Yeah, so I think a few years ago, we're talking a lot about programmatic and DSPs and DMPs, and a lot of investments have been made. And some of them have gone, you know, directly to client side because of the ownership and the transparency angle. But some of them, you know, like you say, we have the clout and we have the scale. And so actually sometimes which is cheaper, right? So we have this halfway house where we create a solution where the client can own and easily undock, I guess, if they did move agency, but you get the best of both worlds with our clout and our pricing structure and our access to the deals that we get with and support that we get from our partners. So it's about maximizing what the investments that clients have made in those technologies, for example, and understanding actually how we can create more out of ultimately what digital offers is. It's not just the reach, but it's the insight, right? So we always talk about data strategy. And what does it really mean? It's using data for insight. It's using data for targeting as well as measurement. So how can we make more out of the infrastructure, out of all of the information that we have within a client organization, whether that is offline research or online research? How do we connect the different points together? And ultimately is all in service of helping them grow their business, right? In a increasingly challenging marketplace because they're digital disruptors, there's regulation, consumers want more and more, everything's now omnichannel, right? Omnichannel or e-commerce isn't always profitable, so some brands are still staying away from that, but ultimately we live in an omnichannel world because that is what consumers want. And even Amazon is going into that world. So how do we help brands where to basically get much more clearer line of sight to their end goal of a sale or penetration or ultimately revenue, and use data in service of that, and then optimize our entire communications in order to drive maximum value out. So we have a lot of brand clients, for example, and they don't sell direct necessarily, or a small proportion of their sales come directly. So how do we understand that actually maybe you get to an outcome where you know your customer because they subscribe as part of the service, or you know they've signed up for something. So how do you connect those offline conversions to your online activity, and how do we do that in media essentially, by knowing that actually we've had an opportunity, not just through market mix modeling, but we had a touch point there that has helped in a potentially long line of consumer touch points to get to that endpoint. And then how do we use that endpoint in order to fuel the entire acquisition process yet again, or the cross-sell or the upsell process in order to generate more value for the brand? So it's those sorts of things that we talk about, is making more use. And I think, sorry, just one more point. The other thing that's quite encouraging is that we find advertisers now hiring better talent, but not to take things away, but more to make the interaction with the agency better. So when we have clients to work with because they speak our language, it's much easier to unblock some of the blockers within an organization, whether that is usage of first-party data or whether that is connecting to other parts within, not within media, but within their customer insights team or within their store operations team to understand stock availability or, you know, whatever it is. So yes, it's great to see that some of the brands really want to get closer to understanding, de-siloing, using data in order to ultimately fuel their growth.
So do you think that sort of, you know, I suppose it's a story of greater sophistication, right, across many different parts of the process. Do you feel that that conversation is just becoming more sophisticated as clients' understanding of what you're doing, what you're providing for them, and their ability to sort of pick and choose a little bit? The word I think you used before is that kind of hub model, plug in and unplug. Is that making the remuneration conversation more sophisticated too?
In some respects, yes. And I think we have a number of different models how we work with advertisers. I'd say it just really depends on the situation of the advertiser. So, you know, like obviously the most common is an FTE versus a commission model, but you've got to understand the spikes and the flighting with which a brand will go to market in order to sort of understand whether that will work or won't work. And, you know, there's always an element of performance. But I think on the more sort of future-facing pieces, it's around articulating the value of the work that we think we should be undertaking together and how we can leverage together, right, how we can write the right roadmap. We've got diagnostic tools that tell us how mature a particular advertiser is and where the opportunities are in terms of driving more value out of the information that they already have within their business but is potentially not connected to our work. And it's, you know, we've got so many case studies and great examples of how we've made this work for other clients to drive that business case ultimately and to showcase that actually that work that is required isn't necessarily a media work, right? It's not a commission model. It's a much more scope of work type model where we are able to support them. And also how to maximize, I think, some of the partnerships that they have potentially directly with tech providers, for example. So how do we get the most out of the engineering resource that maybe a Google will offer and throw into their contract negotiation? Can we tap into some of that with, you know, the in-depth agency experience that we ultimately have? So it's, I think, values is not always priced and the pricing model. It's about ultimately the value add that we bring and making more out of something that potentially is already agreed but left on the table.
Great. I'm going to move us on to second news story, which I wanted to chat about. Australian retailer Woolworths, who, you know, for British people that are familiar with Woolworths, in Australia it's a supermarket. And they also have a big variety store attached to it too, which is called Big W, a bit like Kmart in the US. So there we go, a mishmash of the British model and the American model. Have launched an e-commerce platform marketplace, which they're calling Everyday Market. It's an attempt to bring together some of their existing brands, so Woolworths, the supermarket, Big W, the variety store, and a wider selection of products that are available through that e-commerce platform. And it's designed, they say, consumer interest in a wider range of products, but also to give them an opportunity to test their last mile delivery infrastructure that they're obviously trying to build and improve in the Australian marketplace. So I thought this story was particularly interesting because we've talked quite a bit on this podcast over the last 6 to 12 months about the e-commerce marketplace in general and how that's been given a little bit of a boost during pandemic times. But also we've touched a bit on some traditional bricks and mortar retailers who are moving into an e-commerce model or building out a marketplace model. We talked a bit about what big US retailers are up to in that department. So I'm interested to hear your perspective on the model that Woolworths are trying to build in Australia. I think what's also interesting about this story is they're using their tech infrastructure is built on a Melbourne-based SaaS platform called Marketplace, who were actually part funded by Woolworths' VC division, which is called W23. And that company Marketplace also provides e-commerce infrastructure for some other big Australian retailers. So it's kind of quite an interesting position that Woolworths are trying to occupy here, trying to retain their very dominant position in the supermarket category, make that into much more of an online offering, improve their last mile delivery infrastructure, and also, you know, anchor an investment in e-commerce platform sort of design and delivery that's being used by other retailers as well. So it seems pretty comprehensive. And it's not an, I also add, it's also not an unusual Australian story. You know, it's a small market. A couple of people get a good position and a good stranglehold, make mates with people that can build things well, and they tend to run away with their opportunities. And the other thing I'd add to this too, because I'm very interested in your both your perspectives on this, is that that last mile delivery element's really interesting, because delivery infrastructure in Australia is nowhere near as sophisticated as it is in Europe and probably the US as well. You know, it's a big country with a lot less people in it than, say, the US. If you live in the centre of some of the large cities, you get pretty good reliable delivery. Anywhere outside that, and you and it's a whole different world. So yeah, Lindsay, let's hear from you first on this story.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by this, and actually, what your synopsis there was really useful, because I know next to nothing about the retail market and the retail opportunities that exist in Australia. But obviously, you apart from kind of the chats that we have in the office, and your point has always been that Australia is such a big kind of disparate market. Like, it's very, very difficult and challenging for companies to be able to make it work on a national perspective. They can normally make it work like locally. And I remember you saying that, you know, when Amazon was growing and massive in many, many markets, like, you guys were relying on Alibaba, because Alibaba was obviously kind of very close by in China. And that's how you kind of got your sort of next day stuff. And even then it would take days to arrive, and you just weren't used to having the opportunities that we would have in smaller, more close-knit countries. So I'm what fascinates me is that, as you said, that Woolworths is trying to master everything at once, and I worry that it'll become a kind of jack of all trades, master of none situation in trying to develop a marketplace, which at the moment is only using their own brand, their own brand. They're going to bring other brands into it, but it's going to be curated by them. So not going to allow it. So it's not going to be kind of like go Amazon and go wild, and anybody can create a marketplace. It'll only be curated with ones that they want to work with. That could bring opportunities, a bit of a DTC boom and DTC revolution in Australia. And many of the DTC brands that exist over there could start working with them and help. It could actually help SMEs. I think the last mile delivery thing is interesting, because I question how Woolworths are going to be able to manage that and navigate that and what that looks like. But ultimately, I feel like this is going to be a really good, really, I don't know what the pandemic has done to Australia in terms of retail and what shift it's had into e-commerce versus what it used to kind of, what would used to be formerly bricks and mortar. Obviously, Australia's had a very different pandemic from the UK, and you guys have largely kind of opened up again, albeit locally. So it feels like many of the Australians are able to go out and about again and use bricks and mortar stores. Whereas in the UK, we've been relying much more on e-commerce, and we've really seen a massive boost in that. So I wonder what the e-commerce opportunities are. I feel I'm very ill-informed. I've got loads of questions and no answers. I wonder what the opportunities are in a market like Australia for Woolworths to go down that route, and if they think it would be a success. And the interesting thing, as you said, Rachel, is that there aren't that many, like, that it's easy for a brand to be able to kind of be the top and then get a stranglehold of the market and then try out these new different things. But I wonder if they're trying to throw lots of things to the wall and see which one sticks. But yes, also keep control of themselves by making their own investment. They want to manage it themselves, also control how the rest of the market and actually how the competition scales up its e-commerce offerings, which is interesting because it means Woolworths could actually own kind of the e-commerce technology in the Australian market. Anyway, lots of questions. I understand what's going on, but
fear not, Lindsay. You have an Australian and an e-commerce expert on the podcast.
This is it.
Thank you.
Yes.
Isabel, really keen to hear your point of view and answer to some of Lindsay's questions.
I'm not sure I've got all these answers, but you've got some really interesting questions and perspective, Lindsay. So I'm not surprised that they've done this, because every retailer we speak to wants a slice of Amazon's success, right? And Amazon isn't as big in Oz. Now, I know a little bit about that because my sister-in-law lives there. And I was just flabbergasted a few years back that you couldn't just order books on Amazon. I'm like, what do you mean? That's like one of the first things. Can I buy your kids some books? you know, he was so far away. So maybe that is about, you know, early capture of some of that market share that Amazon hasn't captured. And Amazon obviously, so we see two developments really. One is Amazon has very, very quickly established a foothold and has managed to monetize, I guess, the reach that they've been able to build. Retailers, so that they've got so many consumers now buying from them. We're so hooked into their ecosystem. We go to Amazon, like, you know, product search is mostly on Amazon versus a Google. I think the developments over the last couple of years are really interesting to see. But they've retailers now really want a slice of that, and they're starting to monetize their own data because they've got that same reach, if you think about it. So we see a lot of, you know, supplier-funded deals that are done more in aggregate. You buy tenancies, you buy the shelf wobblers, but you also do some banners and whatever else on websites. We see a lot of that market opening, interestingly, with an Australian company called Citrus Ad, which has recently come to the UK. So they're now on Argos, Sainsbury's, and a couple of other places. And they bring the programmatic piece to that retailer funding, ultimately, or supplier funding on retailers. So that is an interesting model for a retailer because it will help them monetize the reach that they've already got, but provide a lot more control for brands in order to understand what is working, what isn't working, what our consumers are opening up to. Now, the second piece is around the marketplace. So if you think about, I'm a retailer, I want to leverage, you know, the access that I've already got. I want to broaden out my range, but not necessarily having to hold all of the stock. Right? Holding all of that stock requires big infrastructure, but a marketplace doesn't. So you facilitate that, and through the facilitation, and I give you access to my audience, you take a slice ultimately. It's interesting what you're saying, Lindsay, whether they want to, you know, given that Amazon isn't that well established and Alibaba is very much mass, you buy thousands of these products or 100 of said cheap something personalized. that's my exposure to Alibaba. There
yeah,
you go.
Likewise, yeah. Yeah. Were you not buying your sister-in-law's kids' books on Alibaba?
No,
that
no,
way.
No.
Yeah,
that's for sure. So it's interesting to kind of see. I think that could be really interesting. But I think what we all, you know, where I see this is Amazon is so successful not because that they're offering lots of access to ultimately will be cheaper, but they're not always the cheapest. It's the logistics, right? You've got to get those logistics right. And I thought of the component of the way Australia is sort of is structured, or, you know, that you have a lot of vast distances. But if you think about drones and all of that sort of stuff happening, maybe that will, you know, maybe now is a good time where you can in a city deliver quite quickly, and that's potentially quite simple. But then further distances, maybe there's a different way of doing that. In Australia, it's already, you know, with medical services and so on, you know, you already leverage a far greater share of vehicles or transport modes than what we do here in the UK. So I think that's interesting.
I'm really interested, because Lindsay asked the question too, you know, and paused on that. I'm really interested to know if Woolworths have actually got some technology behind this last mile delivery infrastructure piece that they're talking about. Because I read a while ago, this will be a classic Rachel Smith sort of slightly useless anecdote. I read a while ago about an Australian company that were doing last mile delivery infrastructure, building out some technology to support that and trialing it in Southeast Asia. And the whole idea was it was supposed to be, and I don't know if it was, I don't think it was drone based. I can't remember what type of vehicles they were attaching this tech to, but it was mm-hmm. supposed to be some kind of sort of superior way to handle the logistics of last mile delivery in a place where you've got relatively unconnected communities, but fairly dense populations, which is why they were trialing it in Southeast Asia to start with. And I was thinking to myself, if that's something that worked well, maybe that's the sort of thing that they were, and maybe what gave them the idea for it was being in a country that's very sparsely populated, but also quite disconnected. So I just wonder, I feel like there has to be something else going on there. We're not just talking about trucks and a good, you know, delivery infrastructure network. I think there needs to be something else. And drones is a good suggestion, actually, Isabel, because it's just, I mean, to this very day, I must check in with them again. I just, because I haven't been to Australia, of course, thank you very much, pandemic, for the last 18 months or however long it was.
The last time I was there and I tried to get something delivered to my mum's house, I was just astounded that there was no next day delivery. And my mum lives in the middle of the capital city. It's not a big city, but it's got very sophisticated infrastructure, and there was no next day delivery. And this was on a brand's website, but a very sophisticated, well-known Australian brand. And I just couldn't get my head around it. So I think what you're talking about there in the Australian marketplace is a collision of a number of different things, right? Which is probably a growing need and desire for more sophisticated e-com purchasing options, which is a nod to exactly what you mentioned, Isabel, that Amazon don't have a stranglehold in the market. And Lindsay, even though their pandemic experience has been very different to ours, not everybody's been at home all the time. They have been able to move around more. There's been a lot more freedom. I think people just do want to purchase online because everyone else does, right? And everyone's lives have become so digitized. So there's definitely demand. That's what Woolworths are testing. There's something on the last mile delivery that I think is really interesting. Let's wait and see how that shakes out. And the whole making sure they've got an investment in every corner of this potential, you know, opportunity, that is classic Australian corporation, right? It's do something for a long time, which is their supermarket store, get it right, perfect it, make sure you've got stacks of money and a good brand behind you, and then try to get your finger in every pie. Who knows where it will go from here, but it's an interesting one to watch, right?
Well, it would be interesting to see what the investment arm of Woolworths has actually invested in, right?
Yes, so that's apart from
how you'll find out.
The SaaS platform. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, you're right. Anyway, enough musing on life in Australia, because like I said, they've had far too many freedoms in the last 12 months.
Yes. Right?
Far too much freedom. Let's move on to last news story of the day, which is taking us over to the US, where we hear that a number of leading US TV networks are encouraging their advertisers to shift some of their budget and advertising spend from linear TV upfronts into connected TV investments. This is partly to do with these TV networks investing a lot of money in their own connected TV platforms. So this is where they're encouraging those marketers and advertisers to divert their spend. And perhaps also to do with the fact that, you know, some data from the US suggests that TV upfront advertising spend is down year on year. I think 21.9 billion in 2019 versus 18.6 billion in 2020, partly to do with the fact that obviously the pandemic, you know, severely disrupted TV schedules, particularly live TV, which is often associated with a lot of linear TV spends. So sporting events and so forth that were scheduled to go ahead didn't. But again, this is another story somewhat to do with collision of behaviours. We've got a scenario where people are consuming more and more in a connected or streamed TV environment. So are these big US network providers trying to divert spend from linear towards connected TV to realise their own investments that they put into that connected TV channel to try to get ahead of viewers shifting to those channels and or to stem the flow from live television, which has just taken such a hit during the pandemic. So my question to you two is, where do you think this is going to go? Are we going to see, you know, will we start to see a resurgence of interest and excitement around live TV events once things return to normal a bit more? I'm thinking about the Oscars ceremony that was, you know, keenly talked about last week or at the beginning of this week, that nobody was watching it, even though it was an in-person ceremony, obviously not to the same numbers that they would normally have perhaps, but no one was watching it on television. What's happened? Why aren't people interested in that anymore? Perhaps that's a poor example because I'm quite sure if it was a big global sporting event like the Olympics, it would be totally different. So interested to hear where you think that's going to go. And interested to hear if you think that this is just a scenario where, you know, perhaps fueled by the pandemic, we're just seeing a massive shift in behaviour change that spiked in 2020. And even though it maybe won't be sustained at the same levels in 2021 and 2022, we're still going to see a gradual and solid shift from linear to streaming. And so these TV networks are right to try to push their advertisers there because that's going to follow where the consumers are. What do you think, Isabel?
So many questions. I'm trying to remember them all.
this is a classic Rachel compound question. Special.
Right. So what do I think? So I think, as you said, this is a very US-focused article, and the US market in CTV is so different to what we have in the UK. All right. So that's well, I should say first. So in the UK, CTV is very much dominated by broadcasters plus YouTube. Now, would Why have they done those investments? Because that's where the market is moving, and they're partly driving that. And obviously, every organization will want to recoup some of the investments that they have made. But we have found that a lot of viewership is moving that way. And as an agency, we obviously start there. So depending on what that audience strategy is for our brands, CTV does play an interesting role. And that's where we start from. So there's broadly two ways that we look at it. Is one is to extend reach, where we can't reach those audiences through linear TV necessarily, because they're now all, you know, doing other stuff and catching up or watching it on their mobile. And there's a lot of time-shifted viewing happening anyway. And then the other bit is around, okay, so actually I don't want to talk to everyone, and linear maybe isn't offering the right solution. Can I be more targeted? And so by leveraging data, can I reach the right kind of audience? I was working with a brand that was looking after a specific, you know, they needed to target families with four-month-olds, right? So how do you do that? But within a CTV environment, it's easier to do that. You know, gifting audiences, all of that sort of stuff. There's wonderful stuff that we can now overlay, or we can start doing that. It's not as perfect as digital. And whenever I look at what broadcast is doing and I put my digital hat on, I'm like, really, you can't do this? But the market is moving, the infrastructure is improving, and viewership is following that way, clearly, especially for young audiences. But we, you know, I think you commented on it. It's not always the same price, obviously, as linear. And so it does command a higher CPM. And currently, we're not quite, you know, sometimes it works out and sometimes it doesn't work out in your market mix models. And it depends on how those are set up. And we don't always get insight into them. So it's about finding the right kind of blend in terms of getting to the people that we're really hoping to reach with our campaigns. And CTV is definitely a mix within that. And streaming has grown phenomenally. You know, Netflix, Disney Plus, oh my word, they've accelerated heavily. But for commercial, you know, there'll always be an ad-funded model, obviously. I don't think we will see that people don't want to see any ads anymore. And everyone is, even if you have a subscription model, you're starting to open up to ad-funded models. So I think the market will continuously evolve. And I think we've only just seen the beginning of it. But that strict, you need to allocate 30%, I don't think is necessarily going to happen for us over here, because we operate our market is not that sophisticated maybe just yet.
Yeah, I mean, you raise a good point. You know, these US TV networks were actually specifying the amount of investment they wanted to see advertisers push over to connected TV up to 30%. Like you said, the marketplace here is just completely different. And you also raise a good point about price, which is that, you know, obviously CPMs are much higher for connected TV inventory at the moment. And I guess that's going to be a factor, no doubt, for advertisers looking at where they want to put their money. Those costs will be driven in particular directions as more money shifts to that environment and those channels, and more inventory becomes available, and the opportunities become more sophisticated, I suppose. And we're just at the start of that journey, I'd imagine.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. But it's really interesting. IPA had, they run their touch points, and the market has changed so dramatically in the last 5 years. So what people watch when they're as a young audience versus an older audience is totally different now. Mm. It used to be 58% of their commercial time was the same, and now it's only 8%. So we all just watch such different stuff.
Yeah.
And young audiences watch on their smartphone mostly, right? Rather than on the big TV. Everything is totally changed, and you see this polarization, this fragmentation. So that's why, you know, I guess we're blending it a bit more with alongside linear TV, where you get the scale and the effectiveness, I guess, and efficiency. But then if you can't reach the right audience, and where the future is where the young audiences are, right? You've got to invest in other means. And so that blend becomes quite important.
you know, setting up quite a kind of, I suppose, fragmented, landscape there. So actually, all the more reason to be relying on your agency partners to navigate that, right?
Yeah, totally.
great plug there. Very good.
But it's not stuff I do, right? You should talk to some of our AV team. They are fabulous at this.
Lindsay, what's your perspective on this story?
I think that if we focus on the fact, again, that this is happening in the US market, and as Isabel rightfully said, is completely different from any European market. CTV is much more advanced over there. It's still a very big ask. And I feel like it will probably be it's a jumping off point for further negotiation that an advertiser will go, why would I do that? And you're telling me, and the justification given in the article, in the Media Post article, was that it is more expensive, but it's more expensive because there's less clutter, so you kind of you will get a higher share of voice, and it's a more honed environment. Didn't mention the fact that there's better targeting and measurement, which I think would be the first thing I'd mention, because the targeting measurement on CTV is far more sophisticated than linear, and that's not been mentioned. They just mentioned ad clutter. And frankly, who's to say that that ad clutter isn't going to increase? Obviously, we know that in the US, the number of ads you would watch on cable TV is an insubordinate amount of ads. Like, it's more ads than content half the time. On VOD, on SVOD, on BVOD. I mean, for the US, BVOD is largely also SVOD, because all these big broadcasters actually run subscription models anyway. The ad clutter is slightly less, but there's no reason to say that they won't up that and increase that. So you're asking advertisers to invest in something and saying that there are fewer ads, so you get a greater share of voice. They could easily, once there is more advertiser demand in the CTV space, they could easily then increase the number of TV spots that exist within any given piece of content, rendering the cost that these people are paying and the justification for it completely pointless. But I think as well, I just feel like there's the investment model. Like, you can't just say to a marketer, just funnel 30% this way and the rest will be sweet. We'll sort it all out for you. Because the strategy and logic behind investment of linear TV versus CTV from a marketer perspective is they're apples and oranges. Like, you can't just go, oh, I'll just divert money that way. You need to, your KPIs need to be different. The way you target needs to be different. Your kind of who you're targeting and why you're targeting, you know, it's a bit like DRTV versus brand TV. You aren't just buying a TV show, you're buying an audience. It's very, very different. And I think that I imagine the US marketers are more prepared and ready for that. And you'd imagine that for some of the broadcasters that were mentioned, I mean, they didn't actually say that it was them, but you can imagine that the big broadcasters, they will have clients already that are already investing in CTV to a certain capacity, which is, again, slightly different from what it's like in the UK. But I just feel like, are these broadcasters also investing the same amount in CTV, in their own CTV capabilities, technology, as they are in the linear space? Like, I was reading about, you know, Channel 4, want by 2025, they want 30% of their ad revenue to come from digital. But they're also, they're working on prioritizing digital content over linear content. So they're putting their, you know, they're laying their cards on the line and saying, this is what we're going to be doing. And we want your investment to reflect our investment in this as well. If the broadcasters in the US are doing the same thing, then it stands to reason that you would convince the advertisers to invest in the same way. But if you aren't able to show that you're putting the same amount of investment in, why? I just feel there's not enough justification for the advertiser as to why I would do this, apart from you telling me to. It doesn't seem clear to me.
I wonder whether the measurement setup is actually better in the US. And again, I don't know, but you'd find a way of justifying, you know, if I look at our Epsilon business in the US, they're connected to so much stuff. It's a marketer's dream or digital person's dream, right? You go all the way down to closed loop. Yes, you did walk into that store at 1624 and bought that product. So I wonder whether, you know, there's more. Maybe the article just didn't reflect the value that you can offer. And I also saw ad clutter and I thought, well, that's interesting. That's not something that I would think about. But there must be more measurement available. And again, I don't know, is it all harmonized between the different players within the CTV market? But the data market is a little bit looser versus Europe. So potentially there's more opportunity to connect that to outcome-based, you know, data to show, yes, those conversions have happened and your targeting is really valuable and has to help to drive that, essentially.
So. That's true. And from CTV and Linear Space, they work closely with, like, Nielsen run a lot of the measurement there, and Nielsen are trying to connect the dots, and they're working with the likes of Roku and Hulu to do that from a CTV space too. So actually, from the perspective of targeting measurement, maybe that isn't a reason for them to need to go CTV, because they already get that across the board anyway.
Right. I'm going to move us on to the second part of the podcast, where Isabel, we just want to hear a little bit about what you're up to at the moment. You told us that you're pitching loads. Tell us all the juicy gossip. No, you're not going to be able
all
to.
The juicy gossip, all the internal stuff I'm not allowed to reveal.
Stuff. Yeah, yes, please. Yeah.
Well, so we are pitching lots, which is really good. And that's quite energizing for the agency generally. But we're also sometimes not pitching and still winning, which is also great. So you would have picked up the Stellantis global media appointment earlier in the week. So that's really good news. And obviously that sends a hive of activity through the agency as well. I guess in my role, I focus more on what do we need to do in order to future-proof clients. And so that's what I spend a lot of my time on. And helping them, and again, the pandemic has slightly helped in putting online a little bit more at the forefront. I think a lot of the consumer privacy and regulations and cookieless futures obviously put more of those sort of considerations right into the boardroom. The fact that there's so many antitrust cases and, you know, the tech giants being attacked. I guess that it's quite helpful to put digital a little bit more on the map. And when I say digital, it's not just media, right? Because as an FMCG, you may say, actually, only X% of my money, a small proportion of my money goes into digital, so I shouldn't care. But I think what brands have really realized is that we've totally shifted in the market through the pandemic. And you know, Kraft Heinz set up an e-com operation within 3 weeks, right? Others have done it within 5 days. So even brands that are, you know, quite comfortable with their model and it's worked in the past have shifted into much more of an online world and starting to really lean into the data conversation. So that's what keeps us quite busy, which is really good, because it's about helping them to future-proof and to bat off some of the latest disruptors within their various verticals, to really rethink, I guess, how you go to market in terms of your communications, how we can harmonize that a little bit more, how we understand consumers better by leveraging some of those digital signals, and how we then ultimately get to meaningful experiences that you can continuously build on and leverage that, you know, that continuous dialogue in order to build long-term relationships, strong relationships, loyal relationships, right? So whether I'm buying toothpaste, I keep doing that, or, you know, on a continuous basis, and that's the one brand that always sticks in my mind, or whether it's, you know, the phone that I'm going to buy, or, you know some purchase that maybe I do every few years, but it's those meaningful connection points ultimately, and getting the message, the right kind of message to the right kind of person. There's a lot of stuff we're doing with Dynamic Creative, which is really fascinating for a media agency, where we do so much work in targeting and it can get you so far. As we used to moan about this when we worked with a lot of the DMPs. It's like, we do all of the segmentation and then we show them the same thing. I mean, seriously. So finally, you know, we're getting to a point the dynamic creative element is just almost part and parcel of every plan now. Commerce is massive. I talked about Citrus Ad piece earlier, but again, bringing media and commerce closer together. So we think about commerce not as a sales channel, but as an outcome. So how can we make that demand that we generate within media just, you know, seamlessly go through, you know, whatever sales channel we're talking about into ultimately the conversion? How can we help brands optimize that so become less siloed and actually plan media as well as retailer media kind of or e-commerce closer together? And then, yeah, pitches, finding great talent. Anyone's listening to this and you think you're a superstar, knock on my door, please.
Nice. That's good.
Loads of stuff.
I was just about to say two things. One, it sounds like you've just been, you know, sitting around with your feet up on the desk, twiddling your thumbs, doing nothing. And then two things is, would you like to speak on every single one of our panels at ATS London? Because you've basically just done a little summary of all of the things.
Whistle-stop tour.
Totally. All of the things that we want to speak about.
Really?
So, yeah, really. And that must feel – so this is really interesting, right, because it – For you, just going back to perhaps, you know, how it feels from your point of view in those conversations with your brand clients or your clients, you must feel kind of some sense of sort of relief and satisfaction that you're having these conversations, these really quite sophisticated conversations about things that you've been talking about and doing for a number of years, but are really starting to be embraced. And, you know, and perhaps there are some clients that have always been enthusiastic about some of this digital transformation and change, but haven't necessarily either felt that they had the need to make significant changes or were just sort of kind of doing it in their own sweet time for lots of really good business reasons. But the acceleration of all of that this year must be, or in the last 12 months, must be sort of satisfying to an extent.
Oh, totally. But I think yes, you're totally right. I think it's quite energizing. And you know, we have a small but very, very smart team that helps me do all the things that I talk about.
You mean you're not just doing this single-handedly? Oh my God, what a disappointment.
And, you know, every single one of our internal conferences where our Tour Sedun will speak to, you know, where the focus is, that, you know, the team come back to me and like, he's talked to me. That's exactly what we do. And I'm like, yes. Whether it's UK leadership or brand leadership or global leadership, you know, that some of the things that we are able to help our clients with, you know, they ultimately always come back to my team, which is really great. And it's satisfying to see, because sometimes it can be like pushing a rock up a hill, and it has been in some cases that for quite a long time. But I think the pandemic has sort of helped in terms of just maybe making people reflect and refocus a little bit, because if all of a sudden you cannot shift product because you're not deemed as essential product, then, you know, that has significant impact on your business, obviously. And so those routes to market have definitely opened up within the online space. I think it's fascinating also how, you know, that the whole food delivery market has changed as well. I think we all now have got Deliveroo or Just Eat on our phones. But, you know, meal kits from famous chefs, and you know, there's so much innovation in the UK. You know, being able to have these dark kitchens where Deliveroo, you know, give you an IV meal, but even if you're in, you know, wherever, Preston or, you know, somewhere in the deepest, darkest Cornwall, I think it's really interesting how the market is changing and how new solutions are being found. And so that keeps the job really interesting. Ever since I joined this agency, I've always said I have to wear a lot of different hats every day, because you move from so many different conversations from one meeting to the next. But they're starting to, you know, it's starting to become one conversation where we're doing it properly rather than having little bits of, you know, let's trial this out, or let's trial, you know, something else in another area. It's becoming more of a, we've got to embrace this more fully. And that's really good to see. And when you then see the fruit of your labor at the end of that process, because you're not just shifting your reach up by 5% or something, or your engagement rate by X, it's showing they're growing. And that's a good feeling. We've done it together, right? It's not the agency trying to help, but actually you're working with the brand directly and their stakeholders and their joint roadmaps and, you know, or regular catch-ups where we show, have we done what we said we're going to do? What are the blockages? How do we overcome that? That's a really satisfying way of working.
And tell me, has it changed also just the way that you're organized internally within the agency? I mean, you've pointed to the fact that you're recruiting, you know, there's some things for the future that will sort of change the ways in which you operate? Are you becoming more of a fundamental part of the agency?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that. I think that's been the case for a little while, but I think that's probably accelerated even more. But, you know, generally you see a lot more acceleration in the use of data and technology, even within our business. You know, the teams are building some really smart tools and different ways of getting to information faster, which is quite interesting. And just, you know, we have to be more efficient naturally. But we also need to help our clients often faster. That fast bit within that transformation is also something that has accelerated. So I'd say that even the way we plan is done in a different way to get to an outcome quicker or get to a different outcome quicker. And we have this fast and slow lanes, but the fast lane is definitely more of an addition, right? Or utilized a lot more.
Supercharged.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, like when you work with a lot of digital businesses, they use Agile in all of their approaches and so on. And some of that is definitely swapping over into, you know, more automation, faster delivery squads, more superpowered or supercharged intelligence. So how do you use the information about consumers that's out there that isn't just the face value, but you're really starting to dig deeper into the why? I think, you know, ultimately we're here to help bring some of the newer sources of data, some of the newer approaches, new products that we're delivering and developing into the client conversation and into the agency. So bringing everyone on board, I guess.
That's, yeah, fascinating. I've got many more questions, but you're going to have to turn up to ATS London to find out what they are. Thank you very much, Isabel. Delighted we could get this in the diary. It was great to have you on the podcast.
Been a pleasure. Thank you so much. Really good to chat.
Yeah. Thank you, Lindsay. Thank you. Thank you, Isabel. Great to have you here finally.
Yes.
And that was this week's MadTech podcast.